Sir John Baker Carr, Reel 5, you were describing the different types of people who were on this armament specialist course.
Yes, there were mostly officers of in their 20s, like me, but there were two, what I then considered fairly elderly ones, who were probably 32 or 33, who were on the course. And I should add that there were also one or two Cranwell boys on it. Now, this was all part of the Trenchard scheme, that all pilots should learn one specialisation, be it armament, engineering, signals, navigation. And this was in pursuance of that. You would always find some of the Cranmore output who'd done their squadron flying and were then doing their specialisation training.
This course lasted about 10 months. At the end of it, you, at the beginning of 1935, you took up a staff appointment at the RAF station at Andover, which was then the headquarters of the Wessex bombing area. Did the people who'd been on the armament specialist course go to a whole variety of different types of squadron, or were they mainly directed to bombing squadrons?
They went to sometimes they went as a station armament officer, sometimes they went, some of them went to staff jobs in headquarters, as I did. And the station ones might have been bomber stations or fighter stations. They just did an armament officer's job, be it staff or station specialist.
You were on the staff. This must have been something of a change for you, particularly after Basra. Can you describe the kind of duties that the staff armament specialist position involved?
Yes. In Wessex bombing area, we had a number of squadrons divided around the countryside. And indeed, one of them was, in fact, in Northern Ireland. Now, one was responsible in the job I had of making sure that all the officers did their annual training in armament, that is, the bombing, the gunnery, and also the troops as well, who were air gunners. And we had to be sure that the equipment was well serviced on the stations, good working order. We had generally responsible for the armament efficiency, arms efficiency, within our command.
This therefore involved you travelling round most of the time?
Yes, and not a great deal, because quite a few of the stations were within easy range. For example, at that time, Boscombe Down had a... I was at Andover, I should have said, that Wessex bombing area at Andover, and there was, in fact, a squadron at Andover. There was a bomber squadron with Vickers Virginias at, I think, at Boscombe Down. And so they were easy flying distance, and we had at our disposal, we staff officers, aeroplanes, so we could get around the countryside very easily. And the only distant one, really, was... the only distant one...
Was Northern Ireland one of yours?
Well, no. Now I was thinking back, you see, that mixing that up with later on, when I was in 3 Bomber Group, that we had Northern Ireland in that group. And I think I'm wrong in saying that we had in Wessex bombing area. I think Wessex bombing area were all very local squadrons.
As armament specialist in Wessex bombing area, were you involved in the preparations at all for the annual bombing competitions?
Well, there wasn't one. There wasn't an annual bombing competition at that time. This started up, really, with the Americans when they had come into the last war. At least I don't remember any bombing competition, and I think I would have had there been one.
In the middle of 1936, the command structure was changed, and Andover, for a short time, was the headquarters of what was then became Number 3 Bomber Group.
No, and well, Wessex bombing areas were split up into, I think, 4 or 5 groups, and the headquarters in which I was staff, we became 3 bomber group and were moved to Mildenhall. Yes. Number 2 group was formed at Andover, where we had been.
Did the change in the overall command structure affect your responsibilities a great deal?
Not really. The responsibilities were the same. The title of my staff duties was Training 2, Number 2, and Training Number 1 was the flying training, and Training Number 2 was the armament training, and I expect there were a few odds and end jobs chucked in with it. No, they were very much the same. They were really looking after the armament training of the squadrons to see that they were efficient and that that all the apparatus worked properly.
Was Mildenhall actually a new base, or was it just an existing one that you were moved
Mildenhall was a fairly new one, I think, built under the expansion scheme. Yes, it was. A very nice station indeed in West Suffolk.
Was it a fairly comfortable one?
Very. Mm.
What did it actually consist of? It's hutted.
It consisted...
Hutted, was it?
Oh, no. Permanent buildings. Very nice permanent buildings. A lot, I think, were built in about 1936, around the Air Force. And this was one of them. No, they were permanent buildings, as indeed, of course, Andover was before that. But Andover had a lot of buildings that had been temporarily built by German prisoners of war in World War I. And incidentally, they're still there. But Mildenhall was entirely new.
While you were at Mildenhall, were new types of planes coming into service in your bomber group?
Yes, towards the end. Towards the end, there were. And I cannot remember their names, unfortunately. I should have looked them up. I can't remember their names, but there was... I can't remember whether Wellington came in then. I know that... I rather think not. And there was one that we had for a fairly short time, which was a replacement for the Virginias, which wasn't terribly good. I suppose that... I really can't remember the varieties of aircraft we had in the group at that time.
Were there then, with regard to your own particular specialisation, were there any new kinds of equipment introduced in relation to bombing and gunnery while you were at Mildenhall?
No, because I think looking back, probably with this expansion, you see, I must have been there a comparatively short time after this expansion started, when obviously the government and the Air Ministry must have known that war was very likely, and that's why the expansion was taking place. And certainly new equipment was coming in, but I don't recall anything sensationally new at that time.
Did the rapid expansion of the RAF at this time actually mean a good deal more work for you?
I think it meant a little bit more because they were getting new bits of equipment, auxiliary equipment like bomb racks. Now, they didn't necessarily go around with the bomb racks fitted to their wings all the time, and So there was a, probably was a small increase, and of course there was an increase of squadrons.
Did you have to supervise the actual exercises involving armaments, or were you more sort of the technical aspects of whether they were actually working properly?
Well, there was a training schedule down that had to be done by each squadron and obviously the personnel in it, and all I had to see was that the squadron commander had carried out, or his pilots and crew had carried out the required training syllabus in the air.
Did you test any of them personally?
No, the only testing that I did was that there were promotion examinations, and I think it was only the one from to flying officer or something like that, where I had to do a viva voce, but that was pretty elementary.
We talked earlier about the problems of deciding who on earth Britain's enemy could be around about 1929. By 1938, I presume it was quite obvious. Was there a crisis atmosphere at Mildon Hall during that year?
No, there wasn't, because Chamberlain, if you remember, seemed to be negotiating successfully with Hitler, and we all thought that he had averted war, and indeed, if you read the headlines of the popular press, this was also the opinion handed out by them. No, I don't think we ever, right until war was declared, I certainly didn't, and I don't think most of my contemporaries thought that war was imminent. But I remember one army officer we had, who was a liaison officer on our staff, he was perhaps rather more a student of military history. He was quite convinced that there was going to be war and said so.
Were you put on alert during the Munich crisis in any way?
The only sort of alert we had at all was that they put up air raid sirens on the station, which was a bit ominous, and one was very near our married quarter, and it, in order that it didn't freeze up at night in cold weather, it was always just turning over, rotating, and this was rather annoying when I was trying to get sleep. But that was towards the end of my time at Mildon Hall before I moved.
So you were at Mildon Hall when you were selected to go on this even more specialist work at Woolwich Arsenal. Can you tell me a bit about that?
Well, yes, when I suddenly heard, I was promoted to squadron leader, but not in relation to this posting, and I hadn't been promoted very long before I was informed that I was to go to Woolwich Arsenal. Now, this was an unheard of posting for an RAF officer, and how it came about was that up until that time, all the RAF's ammunition and small arms, bombs, had been designed, inspected, and provided, and stocked indeed in large quantities, by the army for us. So with the great expansion of the Air Force, the Air Ministry wanted to have an organization that would do their own research, design and development and testing of weapons. And so I was one of the first to be sent off for this purpose.
What kind of things did you actually do then?
Well, I was attached to the Chief Inspector of Armaments of the Army in their offices at Woolwich, and I went round with their experts to the firms and ordnance factories who manufactured guns and explosives, fuses, small arms, bombs, the lot. And saw how they were made, how they were, first of all, at this time, how they were made and what sort of non-explosive tests were done to them at the factories, and ultimately, of course, what explosive tests were done later out on ranges to make sure that they worked in accordance with the specification. Now, this was I learned a tremendous amount there on the properties of metals and the types of explosives and explosives trains in the form of fuses. And as a matter of passing interest, an army officer who was rather my mentor said, "Well, now I think one of the best ways of learning about fuses is for you to amend the army manual of fuses, which needs doing. And if you get all the leaflets of the changes that have been made, you can get hold of this book. You'll learn all about fuses, which are quite similar to the ones you use in bombs, as indeed they were. And you can rewrite this manual," which I did.
Was that while you were at Woolwich? Or?
Yes.
Relating these sort of technical matters to matters of, if you like, tactics and strategy, were you involved in advising on the potentials of the weaponry? I'm thinking in terms of this great overestimate of what particularly bombs could achieve during the Second World War. Was that part of your instruction, or was it more just the actual technicalities of how things worked?
No, it was learning the absolute technicalities right from the beginning of knowing what the requirements were for a new weapon, from the Air Ministry to doing research work on finding what the best answer was in general terms, and then getting out the design work in the drawing offices, and then seeing it manufactured by firms, the various parts, and have it put together, and seeing it right through its trials out probably at Shoeburyness, the big army ranges, to see whether it worked properly.
Can you give me any... That's in general terms. Can you give me any particular example of a particular weapon that, or bomb or whatever, that you did see through that kind of process?
No, because I wasn't really... I was there to learn about everything rather than to, at that time, learn about everything rather than to engage in the pursuit of one particular weapon at that time.
With your knowledge, or specialist knowledge of bombing and armaments at that time, did you have any views on, for instance, whether the much feared German knockout blow was feasible?
Oh, I think I did. I think I was conned into believing that, as an awful lot of other people were, because the Germans, with their excellent propaganda machine, had made it known to us long before the war started, in about 1936. After all, if you remember the German assault on Guernica in the Spanish War, that did very considerable damage and was held up as a sort of prototype of what the Germans would do to every other town that got in their way. So yes, I was certainly was one of those who overestimated the effects of bombing.
What were you actually doing when the Second World War broke out? Were you still at Woolwich?
Yes. Yes, I was. And under a good deal of bombing there too. German bombing. Yes, I couldn't get away. I thought when war started that I should be able to get out with all my flying experience, particularly in fighter command, that I should be able to get out and use it. But of course, unfortunately, once I became specialised and there were very few of us doing it, there was no escape. No escape at all. Despite many tries to get out of it, get out of this during the war, although I managed to fly a lot of aeroplanes in testing weapons and all the rest of it, I never managed to get out into the fighting line, which of course was a bit hurting.
Did you ever regret from the time when you took your permanent commission and started the specialisation in armaments, did you ever regret not having accepted Imperial Airways' offer?
Oh, no. Oh, absolutely not. Because, I mean, there's really no end product. I think very few pilots of any of the big airways get up into the administrative side and have splendid careers right to the top. And in those days, of course, you didn't have jumbo jets with being paid perhaps £10,000 or £15,000 a year for driving them, or much more, perhaps.
Would you like, just briefly, perhaps, to outline the nature of the kind of things that the specialisation in armaments actually led on to during the Second World War?
Yes. In about 1942, I think it was, the Air Ministry became interested in producing a rocket weapon to be fired from fighter aircraft at ground targets. The advantage of it was much more accurate than a bomb because it got to the target much more quickly. It wasn't quite as accurate as a gun, but it carried a much bigger warhead, obviously, than a bullet. And the Russians had started this, I think, before anybody else, with small rockets. And I was pulled out of the armament design and research business of the three services, and put up into the, I think, Ministry of Supply then, or it might have been Ministry of Aircraft Production, I can't remember which it was. Ministry of Supply was its successor, and formed a special branch to develop the aircraft rocket. And then I spent the rest of the war doing. And also firing it, too, from the air. And it's now, of course, as common a weapon as the gun and bomb.
Was it a dangerous business to start with, developing it?
Well, it was for the first young pilot who fired off the first high-explosive one. We had ones with just solid steel warheads, which were armour-piercing. But they also made one of a big sort of bomb head full of high-explosive, and that had to have a fuse in it, which became armed when the rocket was after the rocket was projected from the aeroplane, and then when it hit anything, it went off. Well, the first one that fired, unfortunately, due to some fault in the fuse, blew up on the wing of the aircraft, and of course the pilot was killed. And although I didn't design the fuse, I was in the organisation that did, and I must say I felt rather guilty about it, and sorry, and all the rest of it. And so when we we'd got the fuse right, nobody else really wanted to try it much. And so I operated, and I was in good flying form in hurricanes, and I managed to hit the targets, which were some old railway engines out of Shoeburyness, and they did the rocket proved very successful indeed, and did enormous damage to these railway engines, and that really the development there never looked back.
Well, let's end it at that point then.